Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. There are fates worse than death. For you English majors out there, this is what's called an idiom, a group of words or a phrase that has a figurative meaning that is not easily deduced from its literal meaning. The phrase originated in the 1781 book Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire and was used in that context to refer to victims of sexual assault. It has evolved in usage over the years, and most of us can probably come up with an image or a situation we can relate to. For me, personally, it's always been the idea of becoming a quadriplegic, the concept of just otherwise being alive and trapped in my own body. For me, is a fate worse than death. Now, a little bit of transition here. Stick with me. If you're in a room full of fighter pilots and you ask who's the best, most likely every person in that room is going to raise their hand. You're infinitely more likely to be the beneficiary of that $100 million from a Nigerian prince, then you already hear the word humility associated with the pilot. So imagine my surprise when I came across a video by an attack pilot, one whose call sign is Johnny Bravo, no less, called There Are Fates Worse Than Death. Stay tuned. My guest today is the commander of the 355th Wing at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, well, at least for another couple of days. Davis-Monthan is one of the largest installations and flying operations in the United States Air Force. He's a 1996 graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy and has been awarded no fewer than 6 air medals and the Distinguished Flying Cross of Valor twice. Colonel Michael Dralley, Johnny Bravo, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Hey, sir, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. I know we've had some fits and starts here, but I'm glad I could finally get you on before you depart. What my understanding, Colonel, is you're in line for a star. What's your next stop?
That's correct. Yes, very lucky and humbled. So I am off to another wing command, the 57th Wing, up at Nellis Air Force Base, following Davis-Monthan, where they are responsible for the advanced training group, which includes the aggressors, exercise Red Flag, the Thunderbirds, and the United States Air Force Weapons School. So lucky on both counts, and like I said, very humbled by the selection for promotion, and then humbled again that I get the honor and ability to go lead and command one more time.
Well, I tell you, we're going to talk a little bit more about Red Flag later on in the program. Before you leave, though, I think it's fair to mention Davis-Monthan, 25 squadrons, 46,000 personnel. Interesting base, Colonel, in that you've got A-10 attack aircraft, also a rescue mission and electronic combat. Pretty diverse.
It is, yeah. And for being so diverse, it is singularly focused on the missions that it does. And I think that's really what is special about Davis-Monthan is, it doesn't matter which airman you're talking to, whether they work in finance or whether they work in civil engineering or they're a guardian angel with the rescue squadron or an A-10 attack pilot. Everybody knows that they're there to execute the mission, to be as ready as they possibly can. And so the mission focus that's associated with Davis-Monthan is just unbelievable. Truly, truly something special.
Now, Colonel, I know the government never makes mistakes. So this, bear with me, there must be an error in your bio, though. You've flown everything from Black Hawk helicopters to heavy transports, C-130s, C-17s, KC-135 tanker aircraft, heavy bombers, B-1s, B-52s, the B-2 stealth bomber, go-go fast, the F-15, F-16. How does a guy like that come to love the ugliest plane ever built?
Yeah, well, I'm a hot baby, so I grew up flying the A-10. That was my first major weapon system that I was qualified in, and spent the majority of my time with the A-10 as my primary aircraft. I was the commandant of the weapons school before I came out to Davis-Monthan and became the wing commander. And at the weapons school, you have 26 combat specialties there. I hate describing it this way, but it's the equivalent somewhat of Top Gun for the Air Force. And what's really great about that institution is it's a competitive process to get in. It is a competitive process to graduate. So you're really working with the top 1% of the Air Force in multiple different missions. And so while I was the commandant there to ensure that I knew what the personnel and the airmen were going through and what they needed, I had the opportunity to fly and partake in missions in all of those different aircraft and see really the best of the best working and improving tactics and training. And it was an incredible tour for me to get a better understanding of the Air Force and as an aviation enthusiast, the opportunity to fly on all those different platforms.
Is it unusual for someone to be rated in both fixed wing and rotor aircraft?
It's not unusual, especially at Davis-Monthan and other bases that have both of them, for a senior leader to get qualified so you can, again, participate in those missions. It is a different thinking when you go from a stick and a throttle to a collective and a cyclic. But the great instructors that are out there and the concepts of aviation all still imply. I would say the biggest understanding that you really do achieve when you do that is what the mission is and what those aviators and support personnel stand for in getting the mission done. And once you have an appreciation for that, it really helps you advocate and make sure that they have the resources that they need to get the job done. And so, to me, that's the most satisfactory portion of the job is when you get that understanding of, okay, I understand what it is you're doing now. I know what it is you're standing for, and I understand your why. I can help better support that. And, I'm just in awe of all the different missions and the levels of risk that they'll take to make sure that the mission gets done and done right.
Now, sir, you and I cross paths on occasion, but you don't know that much about me. You probably don't know I've got personally over 3,000 hours in an A-10 cockpit. What?
No.
On my home computer.
Yeah.
No, I joke, obviously, but I tell you, one of my favorite things, honestly, Colonel, once upon a time, they allowed us civilians into your simulator there on base.
Mm-hmm.
And because I played it on my home computer, I said, okay, put all the settings to 100% realistic. I want to see if I can actually get this aircraft off the ground. And so they did, and I did, and I was doing really well. First time off the ground, I got it up in the air, and I don't know, I was at about maybe 500 feet, and I tried to do that little take off the aircraft carrier top gun roll thing. It doesn't work so good in A-10.
It definitely is unique as far as the aerodynamics, the maneuverability, the systems and the avionics that are associated with it. I would say it is truly an engineering marvel when you think about how reliable and all of the thought that went into designing the gun, designing the redundant systems, everything that's incorporated with it, with one singular purpose, and that is to support somebody who needs it on the ground, you know, whether that is a rifleman, an infantryman, whether that is a downed air crew for combat search and rescue. The evolution of the aircraft and the improvements that have been made to it just have made it a perfect machine to say, there's something on the ground that's trying to hurt one of my friendly fellow forces, and I have the ability to do something about that. And so it really is an incredible piece of machinery. And, you know, I say that not just because I'm an attack pilot, just from a third-person perspective, it is incredible.
Yeah, and I tell you, really, that's what inspired me to have you on the show today, Colonel. And it's not just because you have perfect hair. I was inspired by your TED Talks that I came across on the internet. And so this is a perfect transition to that. Before we go to break and come back, I want to talk about that TED Talks. But explain to our listeners the difference between a fighter pilot and an attack pilot, or the distinction, I should say.
Yeah, I would say the distinction between the two is fighter pilots carry out a number of missions, whether that's strike, whether that's air dominance and air superiority. The attack mission, while similar elements in both communities, do similar missions back and forth, but the attack is very much focused on that close air support for troops that are on the ground. And so that is really the focus that you have is attacking targets or attacking different entities that may be trying to bring harm to those troops on the ground and best support them. And so I would say that's the main distinction. Those similar concepts and tactics and mission sets across fighters and attack. F-16s also fly close air support. Strike Eagles also fly close air support. But in the attack mission, you make that your primary focus and the primary capability that you try and bring to the fight.
Wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Colonel Michael Drelli. He is currently the commander of the 355th Wing at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. In May 2012, he gave a speech to some airmen at Scott Air Force Base, and he started off by saying, I am a Marine rifleman. I'm an infantryman. I'm a Navy SEAL. He got some confused looks. You'll find out more when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by Colonel Michael Drelli. He had a very inspirational presentation, I found. It was a TED Talks. And Colonel, if I'm not mistaken, this might have been the very first DOD TED Talks.
It was. So back at that time frame, TED and TEDx Talks were, I would say, just taking off. And at the time, the author Simon Sinek, who wrote Start With Why and Leaders Eat Last, was putting one together. He had heard about my story and reached out and asked, and would you be willing to do a TED Talk? I didn't know a great deal about him at the time, so I said yes, really not knowing what I was getting into. And it was kind of funny. At some point, I finally Googled a couple of TED Talks, watched them, and I called him back, and I said, hey, I don't think I can do this. And I tried to back out of it. He was like, why not? And I said, well, this isn't what we do. We don't talk about ourselves. We do the mission. We do the job. And you don't highlight what it is that you did. You just, you know, you're humble about it and because you're serving. And he's like, no, that's exactly why people need to hear this now. They need to hear, you know, somebody and a team that put something above themselves and they have that level of service. So this is for the greater good. You need to go forth and do it. So he gave me a really, really good pep talk. And so I stuck with it and, yeah, gave it to the team out there at Scott Air Force Base. And, you know, it's been out on YouTube and other forums now for about 8 years.
Well, I tell you, if you want to know what stops a radio host's heart, it's when the guest says, we don't talk about ourselves. I got 40 minutes to fill here, Colonel. So, and folks, honestly, go Google. There are fates worse than death, and Drelli, Drowley, and you'll see this. And unfortunately, we're doing radio here, Colonel, so, so much of what you present in the video is a little more powerful, but we'll do the best we can. And now, the group that you're addressing, it looked like it was kind of a combination of airmen, and there might have been one or two civilians scattered through there. You begin the talk by throwing them a curveball, saying, I'm a rifleman, I'm a Navy SEAL. Just take it from there, if you would.
Yeah, I really wanted to try and start off and explain what it was that we do and how, as A-10 pilots, we're brought up and what it is that we believe in. And so from a very young lieutenant flying A-10s, that is the lesson that you really get brought up with is, hey, the things we do are not about ourselves. It's about those personnel on the ground that may need support and may need help and may need additional firepower. And that's really how we train, how we debrief, how we talk about everything that it is that we're doing. And so to me, one of the best things that I can do to help support those troops on the ground is know what it is they're going through. You know when they're under fire, it's very tough for them to be on the radio or identify where the fire is coming from. Knowing during the daytime about how far out in front they can see in front of themselves to try and identify a possible enemy that may be ambushing them. Well, how does that change at night? And so when I started off, I said, hey, I'm all these different entities. I'm an attack pilot. But the more that I can put myself in them shoes and have an understanding, the better off I can help them. And that's really what you stand for as an attack pilot and trying to do that.
And I tell you, I want to talk a little bit later in the show about, I'm always fascinated about how the lessons that the military can provide transfer into the civilian world or the business world. And I want to talk a little bit with you about how that empathy that you talk about really, really translates very well to the business world. Sir, I hope you feel comfortable telling us a little more about these stories because it's important that the civilians hear this about what you and your comrades do. You mentioned there's three words that can stop your heartbeat: troops and contact. Tell us about 16 August 2002, the first time you heard those words crackle over the radio in a combat situation.
Yep. So I had just graduated from the weapons school at that Top Gun institution in June 2002, and then deployed to meet up with my squadron. So I'd come from Davis-Monthan with the 354th Fighter Squadron, went to the weapons school, and then after graduation, I was assigned to the 75th Fighter Squadron. At the time, they were at Pope. Now they're down at Moody Air Force Base. So I caught up with them out in the AOR, and we were just starting and commencing combat operations in Afghanistan for Operation Enduring Freedom. And so on that particular night, I was providing escort for a special operations team that had just gotten a high-value target. and they were very concerned that there was going to be an ambush, some form of ambush, as they made their way back to the safe house where they were operating out of. And so it was a challenging night to fly. There were some unusual weather patterns that were in the area. So there was a cloud deck that was kind of layered up to the altitude that we were at. And we were at a higher altitude above the clouds. But we were in radio contact with the team that was on the ground and said, hey, if you need support, then we're going to be here to provide it for you. And we'll figure out how we're going to be able to do that. And so when you're brought up in training, when you hear troops in contact declared on the radio, that's a whole nother gear that you shift into. And what it means is I need to do something to affect the battle space to help them because they need support because they're taking direct and concentrated fire. And so when you hear those words, to me, I make a shift and say, okay, I'm now going to try and put additional risk on my shoulders to take it off of them. So that way I can relieve some of that pressure. I can affect again the battle space. So that way they can either disengage, they can blow through, or we can deal with the threat that's impacting them. And so, as we were holding over the weather and over the cloud deck, all of a sudden the radio started to perk up. They felt like, there was going to be something happening, and then immediately while we were in the middle of the conversation, those words came across the radio, and that was that they were taking fire and they were now troops in contact. And so based off of that, now we had to figure out how we were going to best support them and try and figure out how we were going to navigate through the weather to be able to do that.
And for our listeners, you're in mountains and valleys too. It's not like you're flying over Kansas.
Yes, so we were on the eastern side of Afghanistan near the Coast Guard area. It's pretty high peaks. They can get all the way up to 14,000 feet with valleys that the team was operating and navigating to get to their, again, safe house area. At the time, also, it was in the A-10A, not the A-10C. And so the A-10A is an older model of A-10 before it got a lot of its upgrades. So it had a very basic inertial navigation system in it. It didn't even have GPS, global positioning systems. It didn't have any moving map displays that you see in the current A-10C or current fighters. So at the time, because we had just gotten into Afghanistan, the best maps that we had were holdover Russian maps from the time the Russians operated in there. And so
You read Russian, so that wasn't a problem, right?
No, sir. No Russian. Doing the metrics conversions to feet and trying to figure out what the average terrain elevation was out there. And so in trying to provide them the support they needed, I kind of knew where I was based off our INS and rudimentary GPS that we had and said, okay, if I start here, I should be able to descend on this heading. And if I maintain it for this amount of time, I'll be in the valley, and I'm either going to break out of the weather, or if I don't, then I need to execute a high-performance recovery to get away from the ground so I don't impact one of those mountains that are going on. And so I told the team, hold on as long as you can. I'm going to try and get beneath the weather deck to try and provide some support.
And what greeted your eyes as you came out from underneath that cloud deck, Colonel?
Yeah, so I, in training, had seen fires at night, you know, mainly in one direction for training operations and seen some tracer fire. Entered the weather at a pretty high altitude and was descending through the weather for an uncomfortably long amount of time before I finally broke out underneath. And I broke out with about 1,500 or 2,000 feet to spare. I had my night vision goggles on, so that helped quite a bit. And so I knew I had exited the weather long of the friendlies, and so they were behind me. And so I pitched back into the valley, and then in front of me, there was a multi-axis attack going on. So tracer fire firing up into the mountains, and then tracer fire, return fire, coming down from the mountains. And then occasionally a large flash from a point of origin, and then an impact from enemy mortars that were also being shot, and RPGs that were being shot down at the convoy. It was pretty unreal. I, again, in training, seen a little bit of that. That was the first time I had seen a fully developed firefight and got eyes on it.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the wingman concept later on, but in essence, you told your wingman to stay above the weather. You're going to go down and check this out. So you're down there at this point by yourself.
That's correct, yeah. So I couldn't think fast enough to say, okay, here's a plan to get us both down, and I didn't know if I was going to actually break out of the weather. So I said, hey, I'm going to head down first, and see if I can alleviate some of the pressure the friendlies are feeling, and then I'll figure out a game plan to get the both of us down there if they need both of our fires. So as soon as I broke out of the weather and, like I said, kind of pitched back into the fight, I said, hey, I'm seeing that you're taking fire from both the east and the west sides of the valley. Do you have a priority? And they picked the western side of the valley first. And so rolled in and immediately started providing fires there. And I told the wingman, okay, just stay high for right now. I'm going to try and affect this fight as much as I can. And then once we need your firepower, I'll figure out a way to get you below the weather as well, so that way we can continue to support the friendlies.
And Colonel, hold that thought. We've got to take another break. When we come back, I want you to continue telling this compelling story. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Drowley is in Afghanistan. He rolled in on some bad guys, was doing some gun runs, and when he comes back, he's going to tell us about the worst thing that a pilot can hear over the radio after a gun run and the best thing. This is your host, Ben Mueller Garcia. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Mueller Garcia. We're very, very pleased to be joined by Colonel Michael Drowley, call sign Johnny Bravo. And Colonel, I've learned over the years on a family show like this, we really shouldn't delve into how someone got their call sign. So let's just leave it at that. Suffice to say, you have perfect hair.
Yeah, mine's pretty family friendly. When I was a young lieutenant, my hair used to be pushing the regulations. And any time I got done flying, it would stick straight up in the vertical, much like the cartoon character. And so it was a clean kill. I totally deserved that one.
It was a clean kill. I like that. So when we last left off, Colonel, you're flying in weather and valleys of Afghanistan. And I tell you, this being somewhat familiar with these situations, at least from having interviewed them, you know, special forces, they're pretty cool cucumbers. But, I mean, you could hear those voices literally coming across the radio. You're hearing the rifle shots, the mortars behind. I mean, these guys are in a tough spot. So you come in, you do some gun runs, and for a little bit there, you have said that was one of the worst things you could hear or not hear.
Yeah, that's
which is what?
That's right. As I rolled in and picked out the first area I was going to try and put firepower down on. Again, I saw enemy tracer fire coming down on the convoy, so I picked out a spot. And there's a very procedural cadence you go through when it comes time to employ in close proximity to friendly forces. And so part of that cadence is you tell them, hey, I'm rolling in and I'm about to shoot. They give you clearance to shoot, and then they'll give you feedback of, hey, that was good hits, or what their next priority is, so that way you can continue to affect the fight. So in that case, I rolled in, I received the clearance I was looking for, I opened up on the target that I was engaging against, and then the worst thing you can possibly hear is nothing at all. And so, I didn't know, was it too late for the support that I was providing, where I didn't show up in time, or did I not hit the appropriate target, and I accidentally hit a friendly force? And so as I came off target, there's just dead silence on the radio. For about 5 to 10 seconds, to me it seemed like an eternity. And then finally, the radio came back to life, and I got the feedback of, that's good hits, keep it coming, we need more. And that's the best thing you can hear on the radio, because you know now you're helping and you're taking care of that team, and you're doing your best to keep them safe.
And so that really, and folks, I encourage people to look up your TEDS talks, that was really your first message where there are fates worse than death for an attack pilot supporting those boots on the ground. Not being able to have done what you did would have been a fate worse than death for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, and the way that we're brought up, those teammates that are on the ground are everything. More important than our life, more important than the risk that we take on. We will accept a tremendous amount of risk to try and protect, try and help, and to really make sure they can do what they need to do. And so, to me, you know, the fate worse than death is you were not proficient or able to do the things that we needed to do to protect them or to ensure that they're able to get their job, or you inadvertently hurt them, which happens in combat. There's a lot of fog and there's a lot of friction, and it's a confusing dynamic environment. And so, as an A-10 pilot, where you really stake everything on, my job is to support them, either not doing it in a timely manner where they accept losses, or you are contributing to that loss because you lose situational awareness, are two of the worst things in our world.
Well, I tell you what, sir, our listeners should know that you basically expended all your ammunition. You went up, you got your wingman, you brought him down, or her, I don't know if it which it was, and took care of business. But long story short, 22 men went home that night.
Yep, that's correct. Incredibly lucky. I ran out of ammo, went back up to grab my wingman, flew the procedure again with him in a trail formation. I would never again ask somebody in my formation to do something that I wasn't completely willing to do, and that was not the easiest maneuver to accomplish. He got below the weather and then employed as well until the enemy forces broke contact, and then amazingly, all 22 of the team made it to the safe house and successfully completed their mission.
On occasion, sir, in war, particularly as a commander, things don't always work out. There's another fate worse than death, potentially, and this involved a mission you flew or started to fly in 2003. Now we've moved from Afghanistan to Iraq. An Apache helicopter had been shot down. You had some folks under fire. And tell us what happened there.
Yeah, so that's the other aspect of the job is combat search and rescue and our ability to support that or try and find air crew that may have been shot down in combat. And so when you execute that mission, there's a whole other responsibility now. It's not just to the downed air crew, but as a Sandy pilot, which is what we call ourselves when we're flying that combat search and rescue role, I have a responsibility to protect the rescue vehicles, the helicopters, and the guardian angels or the pararescuemen that are on the helicopters and the entire team. So that is now an additional responsibility and an additional oath that I have is to take care of that team. And so it was a pretty bad night. If you remember, the 19th of March was when combat operations onset, and then on the 23rd of March, fairly bad weather. A lot of different just incidents going around the AOR on that particular night. Two Apaches were shot down. And so we were called in from a special operations support mission that we were doing to try and help out. And overarchingly, it was just going bad for us that night. There was a lot of surface-to-air fire. It was very difficult to ascertain where the downed air crew were. And as we started stepping in, that was the environment that we were facing.
And this is, I mean, it's hard to describe. People need to picture it in their mind, but basically you're leading, you're responsible, you're hearing this transmission. These folks are in trouble, and you don't know if they're going to be shot or captured, but you can tell on the radio it's getting pretty dicey. But you have to make a difficult call at that point in time. I mean, the sky in front of you is just lit up.
Yeah, that's correct. So we thought we had found a relatively safe piece of airspace to hold the H-860s, two ship of them were making their way, and that team, that rescue team, is so incredible. They'll go into any conditions to try and pick somebody up that may need it, and they're relying on us to help make that call of, okay, can we do this? Are we able to effectively make a rescue attempt? And unfortunately, that night, I'm looking up to the north into the Iraq airspace, and it is just filled with AAA. There's anti-aircraft artillery. There's surface-to-air missiles going off and being fired just continuously. And the air crew that I'm talking to, unfortunately, when they took fire, they lost a lot of their navigation systems. They didn't know exactly where they were, which makes it very difficult to find them. They knew that there was enemy forces starting to surround them. And then from my standpoint, my wingman and I are now dodging, again, AAA surface-to-air missiles and at risk of getting hit. And as I'm looking at the situation in front of us, I know I'm in a place where if we go, I may lose an additional 30 lives based off of the way the threat was in front of us and the lack of information that we had. And so, unfortunately, as the mission commander and the person with the responsibility, it's one of those where you look at it and go, okay, am I able to pull this off, or am I going to go, put another 30 personnel into the most extreme risk and harm possible? And I made the call not to do that and said, hey, we can't get it done tonight. It's just not for us. And found out that even during that, while we were trying to figure out where that air crew was, they were captured as we were trying to determine a plan to make our way up there and try and find them. And my wingman and I made several passes to try and see if we could get ourselves into a spot where we could make a rescue, and it just didn't happen for us.
Another fate. Well, that would have been another fate worse than death if you'd led those people Colonel, I want to sort of, I mean, again, I encourage folks, go and Google TED Talks, Drowley, Drowley. You need to see this for yourself. It's really a compelling 15 minutes. You'll learn a lot. Sir, I want to now, I mean, you just got your, I mean, you are going to get the star, right? We pretty much, that's a done deal.
Knock on wood, yep, hopefully. it's on track for that, yes.
Well, when they hear this show, they'll probably give you two.
I highly doubt that, but I appreciate it.
Well, I'm playing with the stars because I tell you, I've as a civilian, sir, I've had a number of, just a couple of honors in my life. One of the greatest was when a fellow by the name of Robin Rand, who at the time was wearing three stars on his shoulder, shook my hand, gave me his coin, and actually called me a wingman. And for those people who are familiar with the Air Force and traditions, that alone is a huge honor. When we come back, I want to maybe have you share some of the leadership lessons learned and how they can transfer into the civilian world. And let's start with that wingman concept when we come back, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Colonel Michael Drowley. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Colonel for a little bit longer, Michael Drowley, soon to be a general. Sir, I really do appreciate your time. I know there's probably people in the background that are literally packing up boxes as we're talking.
not quite yet, but, 30 June, I have the change of command out at Davis Monthan. Very bittersweet. Like I said, the organization, the team that I've had the chance to work with over the past 2 years has just been incredible. So you got to move on because new leadership comes in, and the new wing commander, Colonel Turnham, is phenomenal. He's going to do an amazing job. It has been an incredible couple years, and I've just had an amazing time with our team and truly humbled to have served with him.
Let's talk about some of those lessons you've learned over those years leading airmen. And sir, I tell you, one of the things that is really interesting to me, Laura and I love to binge watch a lot of these, you know, restaurant shows and stuff. And it strikes me that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a 5-star Michelin chef if the silverware is dirty. One of the best change of command speeches I ever heard was delivered by, of all things, a dentist. And what do you do? I mean, you're at the tip of the spear. You're an attack pilot. You got the perfect hair. You're up there taking it to the bad guys. But meanwhile, there's all these other subordinates in support roles. What do you do to keep them motivated and engaged in the fight?
Yeah, from my standpoint, as a senior leader on the base, I would say one of the best things that I can do for our team is empower them to get the job done as they see fit. And so I really try and advocate and execute as much delegation and authority that I can down to the level that where it needs to be. You know, when you look at what helps people go from one level of excellence to the next, if they have the autonomy to do the things that they feel like they need to do to get the mission done, if they have the purpose and say, I know I'm serving something greater than myself, you'll usually get pretty amazing results from that. And so from my standpoint, I really try and communicate, okay, here are the things that I'm responsible for that I can't delegate down because I own the risk for it, so I got these things. But these are the things that you need to have to be able to get your job done. And so I'm delegating and giving you the empowerment and the authority to move out and get that job. And now keep me posted. Tell me how we're doing and let me know where I can add additional horsepower to help out. And so we're really lucky at Davis Monthan. We have an entire command team of squadron commanders and group commanders who take those mission type orders and they move out and they deliver just incredible results.
I mentioned it's change of command season. Like everybody else there, Colonel, I like to stand up and sing the Air Force song, even though I never wore the uniform. But I got to tell you, there's just one part of that song that makes me wince a little bit. We live in fame or go down in flames. Mm-hmm. I had a quote from another, actually it was an F-16 driver talking about the wingman concept, and he said, we will stay and fight together until both of us or neither of us comes home. We know no other way. Never leave your wingman. How does that translate to what, I mean, lessons that we should learn out there in the civilian world, and obviously you practice every day in your leadership position there in the Air Force.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, if there's one lesson maybe the corporate world could take from the military world, it's a little bit of an inverse of what truly is important. And so, unfortunately, you see some corporations that value profits or value the bottom line over the people or over those connections or that wingman concept, where in the military, the relationship is, hey, you can trust me. I will always be here for you, no matter what the circumstance or the situation is. And that is what allows us to get the mission done and to take care of what needs to be taken care of. And so that is really the trust that we have with each other. And it's not to say it's just all happy times all the time. Part of that trust is a lot of accountability. It's a lot of feedback. It's a lot of discipline. But at the same time, I would rather take trust over technical competency anytime. If I know I can trust somebody and say, I can put my life in your hands, and I know that you're not going to run away from that responsibility. To me, that is a difference maker from your average performing teams to a high performing team.
And it's not just in combat. I mean, you say, you know, in my, and this is your quote, sir, in my world, letting something happen to my brothers and sisters on the ground is a fate worse than death. Mm-hmm. But you've also got all these airmen in dorms out there. You've got people who have got other issues, family issues going on. So really the wingman concept and supporting your brothers and sisters applies 365, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Yes, sir. And that's really a Davis Monson. That's been an objective of ours throughout is no airman suffers in silence. And so if they're going through something, if there's something that they're trying to work through or deal with and we don't know about it, to me that's a travesty. And that's why I want them to have the trust in their leadership team of like, hey, I'm dealing with this, or I'm going through this, or I've got this issue. And then they need to have the trust in us to say, all right, we're gonna help you through this, and we're gonna find the pathway to get to success. And so while I would say that concept and that mindset is born out of the fighter culture, the attack culture, it really needs in what we advocate for it to be, no matter what, who the airman is or what their job is, we all believe the same thing. It's, again, not about us. It's to take care of the team.
In that TED Talks video we referred to, sir, you mentioned later on after all the shooting was done and you had some time to reflect, there's a little bit of an incongruency there, and you're mentioning in particular your interaction with your crew chief and just the idea that you're mission, but then it really, you know, kind of struck you in the face that this, you know, folks have got other stuff going on.
Yeah, and that's, I would say as a leader and a developing leader, personally, that's where the light came on for me is, I was always very mission focused, growing up. And to me, there was leadership in the air and there was leadership in being an attack pilot or a fighter pilot. And I didn't have much time for anything else. And on that particular day, the airman, the crew chief that was launching me out, you know, was not having a particularly good day, was going through some stuff. And I really didn't feel like I could be bothered with it until I kind of reflected on it. And I said, you know, that wasn't the right way to interact or lead or be there for that airman. And I had the opportunity to go back out and talk to him and have an understanding of what he was going through and why he was having an off day. And, you know, me being a jerk about it wasn't helping at all. And that's really where I had the epiphany of like, hey, leadership isn't just you pick and choose when you do it. Leadership is a full-time job in all aspects of your life. You know, whether it's in the home or the community or the squadron, leadership is a responsibility. And if you have the capability and the potential to be a leader, you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't embrace that. And so when I look at it, I'm like, hey, if you're talented and gifted, then you need to lead, because that is a responsibility we all have in trying to make things better and improve and solve problems. And so that was the day where the light really turned on for me.
Colonel, I want to impress you with how well I've done my research, so let me just one last quote. We've only got a couple minutes left, but I think this is an appropriate wrap. On those missions you described, just, I mean, the pucker factor was pretty high, and you described, mm-hmm, you're looking at your instruments, you're looking up, you're looking at your instruments, you're looking out of the cockpit, your eyes are always moving. But then at the end of that TED Talks, you tell these airmen, I ask you to never forget to take a second and see what you're doing and what's around you. Don't end up after a 20 or 30 year career not realizing how amazing what you've done really is. What is the importance of pausing, popping your head up, and looking around on occasion?
I'll tell you what, I think it's incredibly important. Before I came to be the 355th Wing Commander, I had an opportunity to serve in Air Force Central Command, and I flew some combat missions, and I was making my way back. And I had an opportunity, and I'm watching these young captains and these young staff sergeants load up C-17s to go into a forward operating base for their special forces. And then I got onto a C-130 that was an aeromedical mission in horrible weather, and watched them work on a patient while they make their way into another airfield. And then I got a chance to get onto a C-17 that was getting loaded up with soldiers who were redeploying. And I remember looking, just going, I used to be that captain. I used to be that young officer, but for some reason it just seems different. And I remember just being so appreciative of, here we are on the other side of the world in, combat conditions, in just an entirely different world. And all they're doing is just going, hey, this is my job and this is my mission, and I'm going to lead and get it done. And I couldn't have been more thankful. I mean, I was just like, I'm so thankful for the position that I'm in, but I'm so thankful that we have those individuals out there serving. And you don't get that unless you take a second and reflect and go, like, this is what we do and this is why we do it.
Well, Colonel, on behalf of myself and all the American Warrior Radio listeners, I want to say I'm thankful to you and your comrades for what you do. I'm thankful you didn't listen to your mom and go to work at a grocery store. And I wish you and your family the utmost success as you continue to defend our nation there at Nellis Air Force Base. Don't be a stranger.
Absolutely not, sir. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for everything that you do for the community. And thank you to the Tucson community and all the communities out there that support us and allow us to be able to do the things that we do to take care of the nation. It means a lot.
Thank you, sir. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. You can find this podcast and over 250 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're everywhere. If you support what we do, check out Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.